You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with Hans Ulrich Obrist. Hans, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Okay, great. It's lovely to talk to you and delighted to join your program.
Hans, tell me a little bit about what's happening with the interview series. I know you're curating and working on a number of projects. Perhaps we should begin with what you're working on at the moment just to get a sense of what you're doing, but then I want to talk about the interviews. So at the moment, what are you working on or involved in?
We've just opened two exhibitions at the Serpentine Galleries. I'm artistic director of the Serpentine Galleries in London, and we've opened exhibitions of Etel Adnan, the Lebanese poet, writer, activist, painter, and basically her first museum show in the UK, you know, showing all the different aspects, all the different dimensions of her practice as a kind of a design construct. And parallel to that, we show Alex Katz, the exonerated painter from New York, who is now in his late 80s, and like Etel Adnan, also bridges a lot, you know, painting and poetry. And we believe that these links between the visual arts and poetry is important. It's been very present in all the avant-garde of the 20th century. I mean, we basically celebrate this year the centenary of Dada. You know, I'm from Zurich, the city of Dada. And, of course, in the early 20th century, you know, when Dada was invented, the connection between art and poetry was very strong. It was also very strong in surrealism. And I think we live in a moment where this bridge is very important again. So that's really an important aspect of our summer, and we've just had poetry park night with the artist Sandra Perry, where she basically connected her practice and reconnected her practice to the poets Fred Moten and Eileen Miles. We've just had two poetry events where Etel Adnan and Alex Katz invited poets of their choice. So you can very much say it's a summer at the Serpentine between visual arts and poetry. We are also open our architecture program, which based on the pavilion Julia Payton-Jones invented in 2000 with Zaha Hadid. So Julia and I devised two programs this summer with architecture. We basically invited Bjarke Ingels from BIG, the office BIG in Denmark, to design the pavilion, and he created the extraordinary out of the ordinary, these very ordinary sort of boxes were stapled and form almost they form a climbing wall, but they also form a form of cathedral. It's from the lawn in front of the Serpentine, and then parallel to that, we also curated four summer houses where four architects answered to this Queen Caroline house, to this Queen Caroline temple, with kind of contemporary structures. Of course, the pavilion is a content machine that is being used for park nights, for events and talks every Friday throughout the summer. So that's what's happening right now in London at the Serpentine Galleries.
So let's talk about your interviews. You've interviewed what hundreds of people now. I know over 100 interviews have been out, but you've logged over 1,000 hours, it seems. Where are you up to in terms of interviews? I want to start from the beginning and discuss the process, but do you know how many you've done at this point?
2,785 hours so far. And that obviously, you know, appears to be a quite big archive, but it's still a very small archive in comparison to my great inspiration, the Chicago art historian Stutz Terkel. Stutz was one of the reasons why I started to do recordings. And he was also the one who inspired me to actually then, at a certain moment, go beyond interview books and actually write books. You know, I think basically to use oral history as a, you know, as a kind of a point of departure for writing books, and sort of my more recent books like Ways of Curating have actually been very much, you know, of course, based on all the conversations I've been doing. And so it's very much, I would say, a practice which is inspired by the early influence from Stutz Terkel. It's also something which just reflects in the way I work. And I mean, I basically have everyday conversation with artists. I have everyday conversation with architects. I have everyday, you know, conversations with scientists, composers, and out of these conversations grow my projects, you know, the exhibitions, books, architectural structures, you know, I'm producing, I'm curating, they always have as a point of departure these conversations. And ever since I'm a teenager, I've had infinite conversations, to quote Blanchot. There's this beautiful book by Maurice Blanchot about infinite conversation. I have got these infinite conversations, you know, with artists and other practitioners. And obviously at a certain moment, I would say around 91, 92, I started to think, you know, maybe it's interesting to record this conversation for posterity, but also because maybe they could be used for someone else. Because when I was a teenager, I kept reading these books by David Sylvester, you know, when he had conversations with Francis Bacon, and I was so grateful, you know, Sylvester had recorded these conversations because they were an amazing. They were really, for me, a way to get into art. They literally, you know, pulled me into art to sort of listen to Bacon's voice through Sylvester's, you know, excellent questions. And so I thought, you know, if I have these recurrent conversations with artists, maybe in a similar way, one day it could be interesting to do books. But obviously at the beginning, it was, you know, far out of my reach when I was starting that they could ever be published. I just started to build up these archives. And then little by little, they became books. But obviously they're also all, I mean, many of these conversations have been filmed. And that's thanks to another great influence on my archives. Besides that circle, I would say the other great influence was Jonas Mekas, because I met Jonas quite early on, I would say also in the early 90s, thanks to my friend Agnes B. In Paris. And we've been friends with Jonas ever since. And I would say that that it was Jonas who really said, you know, it's a pity that you just record the voices, because why don't you just put the camera on the table and have the talking head? And I'm very grateful to him for that, because it means that my archive is actually, you know, an archive of talking heads, and that as it's all been digitally filmed, there is, of course, a whole potential to do something one day with his archive. We started to tag it, and it's obviously an enormous task to tag almost 3,000 hours. So we've, you know, only been able to tag a few. We've tagged the whole Cedric Price part. But in the long run, there is obviously a great potential of tagging this archive, and then it will become searchable according to keywords, according to artists, according to topics, according to different geographies, and also according to, you know, to different themes. And you will have also the possibility, once it's being tagged, that actually these different talking heads in my archive could start to talk to each other, and you could even have people alive to talk to people who are no longer with us. So I think there is a great potential in the future to actually do something with my film archive. So far, it's mostly been books and transcripts. So the whole exploration, so to say, of the filmic part is in big parts, you know, unrealized.
And all those films, all those videos, are they accessible anyway, or those are in your private archive? That's not something that the public can view now, is it?
No, they are my private research archive, you know, because they've been, ever since the early 90s, you know, I've documented all my researches, I've documented all my meetings, I've documented, you know, my meetings with artists. And so the desire, the will, is to definitely make it all accessible one day, you know, but it's a lot of work to actually, because it wouldn't be meaningful to just put thousands of hours of stuff online, but it would have to be, you know, not only edited, but tagged. Tagging is the key thing, so that it becomes searchable.
And to talk about the beginning process of these interviews, they were initially all audio. Is that correct, before you started using video?
Yeah, it's absolutely true that the first couple of years it was only audio. But very quickly, you know, I would say it was sort of around 93, 94 that I started to then film them. And around 95, you started to have the first small mini-DV, kind of very, very small digital video cameras. And I always felt somehow uncomfortable with having this big camera between me and the person I would talk to, because it created a sort of an artificial strange situation. But once these tiny little digital, you know, video cameras, the mini-DV camera came up, I bought very early on such a camera, and I felt much more relaxed, because it wasn't imposing, it wasn't an imposition anymore. It just sat on the table as an almost kind of a by the way, and, you know, it didn't really matter. And ever since, I've been filming, you know, many of these interviews. And then, of course, in the last couple of years, you know, it's mostly been filmed with, you know, with the iPhone. I mean, the thing is also, at a certain moment, social media entered my, you know, my practice, and I'm using today, I'm using Instagram, Twitter, I'm using Facebook Live, I'm using Periscope, I'm using Snapchat, and I try to use all of these platforms for another aspect of, you know, of my work. So the Instagram is basically a movement, is my movement to save handwriting, to avoid the extinction or the disappearance of handwriting, because I realized in conversations with Umberto Eco and Etel Adnan, that handwriting more and more disappears, and you know, people who actually grew up with digital media less and less develop handwriting. And rather than to complain about the disappearance of handwriting, I thought it would be nice to use my Instagram feed to actually celebrate the diversity and beauty of handwriting. And this is why we started my Instagram, where I post every day, you know, a handwritten sentence by an artist or an architect or a practitioner. Then I also tweet those handwritten notes, because I think it's interesting. They're very often short text, more or less of the length of a tweet, approximately 140 signs, you know, a couple of sentences. But obviously, when you post an image of a handwritten sentence, it sort of undermines what Twitter really is about, because Twitter is about typing these 140 signs. So, you know, we have it on Instagram, we have it on Twitter. And then at a certain moment, I start thinking, you know, how could I actually also, for my conversation project, you know, use social media. And so I started to live broadcast, actually, whilst I film the conversations. I film them now on the iPhone. I live broadcast them. And initially, it was mainly on Periscope. But now it's also, since Facebook has now this new Facebook Live possibility, I also have it on Facebook Live. And so that's an important part of my...
And can you interview with Facebook Live, though? Usually your people are talking with Facebook Live or Periscope and things like that, but on Twitter. But is
Yeah, I just film them. Whenever I meet someone, you know, whenever I meet an artist and I start a conversation, I very often would just switch on the Facebook Live, and then it broadcasts the conversation. It's like my own talk show in a way.
That's exciting. It is amazing
how fast you can book. Snapchat. And more recently, I've also started to use Snapchat. And again, I thought, you know, I'm not interested in using it as a vanity project or sort of, you know, just kind of document my life. And it has to be connected to my practice. And in a way, I was wondering, you know, what could Snapchat do? And I actually realized that it's great to Snapchat short performances, short kind of happenings, short interruptions. And so I very often now on Snapchat, you know, for example, the other day from New York City, I was in New York City yesterday, we Snapchat, you know, a series of short performances of Brian Bellot and Jamie and Giuliani, and basically we Snapchat series of short performances they did in their studios. It also, you know, and again, it builds an archive, because of course, even if Snapchat and Periscope are only online for 24 hours and then it perishes, it disappears, you know, I can save it on my, I can save it on the phone, it goes on the cloud and builds another archive, and it adds to the ever-growing archive of my infinite conversations. So it's been very exciting to actually use social media for these different aspects of my practice, to document performances and events and happenings, to document and also live broadcast, almost like a talk show, my conversations, and in terms of the Instagram, you know, to actually launch a movement, use it for a movement to celebrate and save handwriting. And I think this idea, you know, of we live in an age of globalization, and it's not the first time we have globalization. You know, if you look at the early 20th century, I've just been rereading the diaries of Harry Graf Kessler, the great German impresario and curator and thinker. And when you read about the early 20th century avant-garde, it's a very cosmopolitan situation. You know, Berlin in the 20s was unbelievably cosmopolitan. And in the diaries of Harry Graf Kessler, you see how actually forces of nationalism and xenophobia and, you know, opposite forces to this very open spirit of global exchange and dialogue and conversations have actually destroyed, you know, in the 20s and 30s brutally this you know, this spirit. And so it's very interesting to reread the diaries of Harry Graf Kessler, because it's obviously in a very scary way connected to what's happening today with these nationalisms and xenophobic moments which we can appear all over the world, which are in pure antagonism to these, you know, possibilities of global dialogue which we now have. And I think the writer who most importantly summarized and also brought to a point these whole aspects of globalization and also these dangers of globalization is the great Edouard Glissant, who was a philosopher, poet, and writer, the late Edouard Glissant from Martinique. And he wrote a lot in the notion of the archipelago. He wrote on the notion of, you know, blending of cultures, of of creolization. But he also coined this notion of mondialité. And, you know, I've got this ritual that every morning when I wake up, I read 50 minutes of Edouard Glissant because it keeps me kind of focused. But this is a key question to negotiate this mondialité. And mondialité is a global dialogue which actually doesn't reject mixings, which understands that actually, you know, our identity is not static. Our identity is shifty. Our identity is changing all the time. And it's in dialogue with others that, you know, our identity becomes richer, more diverse. And so Glissant talks a lot about this idea, you know, to actually engage with all kinds of different dialogues. And yet at the same time, that doesn't mean that we lose our identity, but the identity becomes actually, you know, as he said, it becomes richer. And so mondialité is in a way, it doesn't exist in English, you would call it mondiality. It's sort of mondialité, according to Glissant, resists the homogenizing forces of globalization. It resists extinction. So, you know, it would basically resist the fact that handwriting disappears. It resists the fact that certain languages disappear. Yet at the same time, it doesn't fall into this pitfall of refusing the global dialogue as a counter-reaction, as we can see now in such a massive way, in all over the world, but it actually embraces the possibilities of this global dialogue, you know. And I think in a way, this idea of Christo is very important, but it leads us also back to Etel Adnan, you know, the great poet from Lebanon, Sausalito and Paris, whom we're showing now at the Serpentine, who also talks about mondialité, because he says basically the world needs togetherness, not separation. The world needs love, not suspicion. The world needs a common future, not isolation. And that's, you know, what art can do. And that's why, you know, I think it's so urgent to do exhibition.
Well, I think that's also what the conversation, as you're saying, can do. The global conversation is certainly about, you know, the world at least having a dialogue and potentially resolving some of the many conflicts going on. When you choose to interview people, are you picking certain people because you feel they'll contribute to the global conversation in a specific way, in a sense? Yeah, how do you choose the variety of people that you interview?
You know, I think in a way it's very much flânerie, you know. I'm a flâneur, and in a way it has a lot to do with, you know, a serendipity of encounters. That's why I was very inspired as a teenager by the diaries of Harry Graf Kessler. And these diaries are really very urgent, you know, I think for the 21st century. It's amazing to reread them now. And there is an exhibition in Berlin at this very moment, which actually brings together the diaries of Kessler. And what makes his diary so unique is that he really, in a very serendipity way, you know, encountered all the great figures of his epoch, of his time, you know, and would then put them in contact, would put them in connection. So he would meet artists from Toulouse-Lautrec, you know, to Edvard Munch, you know. He would meet great composers. He would meet the impresario Diaghilev, who founded, you know, the Russian Ballet. And he would put, you know, people in touch with each other. So he was a junction maker, you know, founded a publishing house, the Cranach Press, to make their work known. He was he built bridges. He would bring together, you know, Hofmannsthal with Diaghilev, and you know, he would basically bridge many, many gaps. And he was a flâneur through, you know, the avant-garde of the early 20th century. And I think in a way, my practice I've been very inspired by that. I started originally with artists and meeting, you know, artists all over the world. And at a certain moment, I realized if I want to understand the forces which are effective in art, you know, it's important to also understand what's happening in science, what's happening in music, what's happening in technology, what's happening in architecture. I started to bring more and more the practitioners from these different fields, you know, together. And that, of course, happened through my medium, which is the exhibitions. I'm a maker of, you know, in German, you call it a Ausstellungsmacher. I'm someone who makes exhibitions. I'm a maker of exhibitions. But, you know, it's exhibitions not only of objects, because if you look at the history of art, of course, from the 19th century to the 1960s, it was foremost a history of objects. But in our time, you know, since the 60s, there was, of course, dematerialization, more conceptual art forms. So you can say it's curating of objects, but also curating of non-objects. And then You know, Michel Serre talks about quasi-objects, objects which only gain a meaning once you interact with them. And so it's also a curating of quasi-objects. And then Timothy Martin introduces an even other, yet other notion, which are the hyper-objects, which are things which clearly go beyond, you know, the frame or the limits of or the boundaries of an object. For example, climate or the weather would be hyper-objects. So I'm very interested in this idea, you know, of the curator or curating, making junctions between objects and objects, but also quasi-objects, non-objects, and hyper-objects. And then, of course, in all of that, very centrally, it's actually to make junctions between people. You know, it's part of my practice to bring every day, as did my great inspiration, Harry Graf Kessler, to bring together every day, you know, practitioners from different fields. And I do that by introducing them in person, but also through my favorite medium, which is the cyber introduction, where I just, you know, write an email or a letter to two practitioners where I think, you know, they should meet each other. And then, you know, within a different field, within a specific field, to come back also to your question about how I choose the interlocutors, you know, I think Richard Hamilton once told me that Marcel Duchamp told him, that the great Marcel Duchamp told him that we, you know, foremost and often only remember exhibitions or practices which invented a new rule of the game. And so obviously I'm very interested in this idea of practitioners who, you know, who invent a new rule of the game within their practice, who are, you know, who are game changers, who shift into something truly unexpected and do something truly new. And, you know, the medium is the exhibition. I think it's fascinating how artists, you know, throughout the 20th and 21st century use the exhibition for very often, you know, radical experiments.
And there's two kinds of interviews, it seems to me. Typically, there's the kind of interview that journalists do where there's a series of questions and they ask them, they're answered, and it ends there. But you're also having conversations that continue. You interview somebody, it stops, and then you pick up and you interview them again. And I know you've done this with many people, and some people you've only interviewed once. What I wanted to ask is what changes when you have, I assume that kind of extended conversation is what you're after, and how does that differ from an interview? You're actually getting, there's an intimacy that's building there, isn't there, when you have an extended conversation?
Yes, absolutely. That's a very important point you're making, because I think, you know, in a way, the conversation David Sylvester had with Francis Bacon, this conversation developed over many years. And, you know, I met Gerhard Richter, for example, you know, when I was a teenager. I met Osmary Tockel, you know, when I was a teenager, and I've had conversations with them now for more than 30 years, you know, and so I would say we can say that in a way these are very, you know, long-term, long-duration conversations, and of course it allows to go more into depth. It allows also, because there's a, you know, there's a trust, there's a friendship, but it also allows to little by little cover sort of different chapters of someone's practice. And I'm always very interested, you know, in terms of finding also topics and themes for, you know, artists who never have talked about before. So, for example, after many years of conversations, we realized that Gerhard Richter never talked about his relationship to architecture. So we did this long conversation with him about him as an architect, him as somebody who builds spaces for his paintings, who invents spaces for his paintings, you know, and that created a very unexpected conversation. Then a few years later, we did a conversation with Gerhard Richter about his books, because we, you know, I realized that artist books are for him very important, and he spends as much on an artist book in terms of time as he would spend on an important cycle of paintings. Yet the artist books he invented are much less known than his paintings. So we thought it could be wonderful to talk about his entire practice through his books, you know. And so that produced this unexpected interview about, you know, Gerhard Richter's artist books. So, and that obviously was possible because it was based on almost 30 years of conversations, and then all of a sudden we found out. So I would say, you know, it is an extraordinary privilege to be able to speak to an artist again and again, and also accompany the work over so many years. I mean, it's also Pierre Cabanne did these very deep sessions with Marcel Duchamp, and it's just really wonderful to do these long recordings. And they also don't really have a purpose at the beginning. You know, they are not made for something or for someone. There isn't kind of like a utility in that. That's what I mean. It's a serendipity. It's a flânerie, you know. It's a conversation which is there and it's driven by, I would say, the medium which drives it, is curiosity, you know, and the desire to know, you know, and And then at the same time, of course, also, it's not only a unilateral conversation. This is why there are more conversations than interviews. It's not just like, you know, me asking these different artists questions, but it becomes an exchange, because obviously, and that is something which has happened from the very beginning. You know, when I was a teenager and I started to visit artists like Rosemary Crockell or Fischli Weiss or Gerhard Richter in the late 80s, you know, after sort of 86, 87, you know, I would then learn something about their practice and in a way bring in that knowledge or bring in that experience to the next conversation. So it's an endless chain, you know, and then of course, whenever I would do a conversation, also artists would mention artists I should look at or works I should look at or books I should read. And then I would go and, you know, talk to those, you know, mentioned artists or writers or, you know, or novelists or scientists, you know, who inspire the artists. And so it's a kind of an endless chain. And I would say it has a lot to do with, you know, I grew up in the eastern part of Switzerland. My parents always took me to this monastery library in St. Gallen. And I think I was very fascinated by these medieval books where there was this attempt, which of course, you know, an attempt which is always to fail, because it's impossible to know everything. But this idea of carrying all the knowledge together has kind of always been an obsession of mine. And there is clearly, you know, something which is to do with the early inspiration from childhood from these medieval codexes, you know.
So tell me more about that, because that's very unusual. Your parents took you to monastic libraries with medieval codexes. Most people's parents didn't take them to libraries like that. Why were you going there? Was that part of looking at something else, or that's a curious place to end up as a child?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it has to do with the fact that, I mean, often the first museum, you know, our parents take us to as children has a very big impact. You know, you see this as artists, as curators. I suppose it's true for all professions. And you know, my parents, because it was near St. Gallen, there is this very famous monastery library. It's the cloister plan is the map of the monastery from the early Middle Ages. So my parents would take me to that. It was the museum nearby where we lived. And they realized how fascinated I was and by these early books. And, you know, you could actually, also for me as a child, it was a very profound experience that you could, you know, you could actually, with gloves, you could make a meeting, an appointment, and then they would allow you to look at these medieval books wearing white gloves and, of course, you know, being there, you know, with obviously somebody from the library there watching you so that, you know, that the necessary care was given to the exercise. But it was actually possible to touch these amazing books and look at them. And then I think the other thing was, at a certain moment, I went to the Kunsthaus in Zurich. That then was on my own because I started to be interested in art. And there I saw the work by Giacometti, these long, thin figures by Giacometti. And that was when I completely, you know, became obsessed by art and would always go on free afternoons to the museum. So that Giacometti was the ultimate trigger.
There's a number of things that I'd like to continue to talk about. Unfortunately, we have limited time, but you're calling from London right now, and we're talking at a time when there's political upheaval there. And just to touch on that a little bit about the vote to leave the European Union, what's the feeling like in London now? Is that affecting you and so many artists, or is it not? Over here, it seems quite extraordinary, but there, in terms of, you know, your perspective on culture and galleries and shows you're mounting, is anything noticeably changing from that or happening at the moment in regard to that vote?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I've written a text about this, because obviously, you know, art is very much about, as Delarman says, you know, art, I think, is about tolerance. It's not about, you know, it's not about separation. You know, the world needs togetherness, not separation, love, not suspicion, a common future, not isolation. So I think, you know, there's a great solidarity in the art world, of course, in relation to that. And Wolfgang Tillmans brought beautifully all the artists together in his campaign, you know, against the Brexit. And, you know, I think artists have always gone beyond, you know, national boundaries. Art is the opposite of nationalism. And it's very much about, you know, about tolerance, about love, about togetherness, and about, you know, about the common future. And I think, you know, art in such a moment is more important than ever, and particularly also in such a moment of confusion, you know, art is a very important form of hope also. So I think, you know, art has a very important role to play.
It's been wonderful talking to you about all this, and I wish you the best on the show. Is there books coming out? Are you working on a book now that we should be looking for? What will be the next iteration of the interviews? Are they? Is there another volume coming out? Will there always be more volumes coming out?
Yeah, actually, this week a new pocket version of The Lives of the Artists and Lives of the Architects has come out. It is published by Penguin, and it includes you know many of the conversations I've had with artists, which are recurrent. So you know, it basically shows from artists like Ernest Mancoba, or great pioneer of South African art whom I met at the very end of his life. He was 100 years old, who was part of the Cobra movement, and he's still not known enough, but it's a very long conversation with him. Or, you know, Monir Sharoudi Farman Farmayan, who is now in her 90s, who is pioneering Iranian artists. Or, of course, the late Richard Hamilton, the father of pop art. Or Elaine Sturtevant, you know, another visionary artist who died in her late 80s a couple of years ago, American artist who she never really thought of it as appropriation, but she basically repeated artworks, but it was a repetition and difference of other artists. And so it was a very early, you know, connection also. Long time before the digital age, she worked with cybernetics, with sampling. Gerhard Richter is in that book. So it's artists I have had conversations with over many, many years. It's exactly what you asked about, you know, Oskar Niemeyer also, of course, whom I've had conversations with on many occasions. Actually, interesting, when I went to see Oscar first, you know, I was told by the office that he doesn't need a translator because he speaks French perfectly, and I speak French. But then on the day of the interview, he wasn't in the mood to speak French, and he would only speak Portuguese. So we were lost without a translator, and I would ask him the question in Spanish, and he would answer in Portuguese, and I had no clue what was the answer. So it was almost like a cadaver ex key, because I had to have a guess what could be the next question. And then luckily, a few years later, we had this wonderful conversation with him where I went to see him with Norman Foster, and that became a very long conversation about the future of the city. So that's included in the book. And then, you know, many more artists, from David Hockney or Frank Gehry to Marina Abramović or Nancy Spiro to younger artists like Philippe Pareno or Tino Segal, but also architects like Zaha Hadid and... I would actually like to dedicate today's conversation we are having to the memory of my friend Zaha Hadid, who so sadly passed away a few months ago this year. And she told me in one of our very last conversations that there should be no end to experimentation. And I think that is a great motto for, you know, which I think of every day. It's a very great encouragement to continue and facilitate, you know, great forms of experimentation.
I agree. Hans, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been wonderful to talk to you.
No, it's a great pleasure. Thanks for your questions.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with The Lives of the Artists, Architects, Curators, and More.